Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, I'm Freddie Sayers, and this is Unheard. Back in March, everyone's world suddenly changed.
From this evening, I must give the British people a very simple instruction. You must stay at home.
So on day one of lockdown, we launched Lockdown TV, a place where we could gather experts, scientists, writers, politicians, thinkers, to try to help us understand what was going on in this strange moment and what kind of world we were going to get at the end of it. And now, due to popular demand, here we are in podcast form. Welcome to Lockdown TV. So we have talked about lockdowns in various capacities for months now, but usually on the science. Do they work? Are they the best policy? Should they be introduced sooner, later, on all of that? Well, today we're going to talk about something slightly different, which is the legal implications of lockdowns. And here to work this out with us, I'm delighted to say, is Adam Wagner. Hi, Adam.
Hi.
So you're a barrister at Doughty Street Chambers, expert in human rights. You're also the special advisor to the Joint Committee on Human Rights' COVID-19 inquiry. And you also host a podcast called Better Human, which is all about human rights. So I think we can say you are well-credentialed in the realm of human rights and law.
That's right.
Let me kick straight off with something that you said earlier today that I thought was fascinating. You put it out on Twitter, which is that you asked the question, if COVID-19 had risen in a liberal democracy in Europe, for example, do people think we would be where we are now, where lockdowns are considered the kind of normal, orthodox policy response? What sort of answer did you get to that question?
Well, I mean, you can imagine it brought out some strong opinions. And I did it deliberately because I've been really trying to be careful throughout this pandemic to stay in my box in terms of commentary on the legal measures. I mean, there's been the most extraordinary amount and extent of legal measures, which we can talk about what they are and how they work. But obviously, I'm a lawyer. I'm not an epidemiologist. I'm not a scientist. So it's not, you know, I can comment from a human rights perspective, you know, are these measures proportionate? But it's very difficult to say whether they're right or wrong. And I try not to say that. But I do think as we hopefully in the next few months come out of this phase of the crisis, of the pandemic, and there is a vaccine, you know, put into millions of people in the population, hopefully already there are millions of people with the vaccine, the balancing factors are going to change. And this question about whether lockdowns are worth it from a rights perspective will have to come back. It was pertinent at the beginning of the lockdown, at the beginning of the pandemic. It's kind of, I think we've got into a certain amount of received wisdom that lockdowns are the way to deal with this virus. And it's worth starting to think through again, you know, what is the appropriate liberal democratic rights focused response to that issue? And I think it was worth asking the question, was it necessarily going to be this way? And that is part of the analysis.
In terms of legal principle, does that broach new ground then? Essentially treating everyone as if they are a risk or at risk, whether they want to be treated like that or not. Is it a sort of Is it a new approach from a legal point of view?
I don't really think there is a legal precedent. I read somewhere that Matt Hancock, I mean, this is, he's not confirmed this, but it was a sort of informed view that Matt Hancock had described the what he wanted from the lockdown to be Napoleonic within the cabinet, as in Napoleonic in the sense of reversing the usual presumption that everything is legal unless it's explicitly disallowed, to the presumption that everything is illegal unless it's explicitly allowed. And that's enormously different to the way the way ordinary people engage with, are bound by the laws. The fact that when you leave the house, you have to look at a list of reasons you are allowed to leave the house and be outside the house for, is I think fundamentally different to anything in the modern era.
And that's quite frightening, potentially. I mean, it's gone on for a year now.
It should be frightening. If there's anything we've learned from history, it's that is that emergency powers tend to not, you know, persist beyond emergencies. And once a public authority gets a power, it's quite difficult to take it away from them because they become used to it. So, I mean, I'm not and never have been of the view that there is some sort of fascistic takeover of the UK and this is all, you know, totalitarianism by another name. I really don't think it is. I think I would look at it through a human rights lens, which is that the right to life and the duty to protect life are absolutely fundamental. And when you've got a virus of this scale, of this infectiousness and of this deadliness, tens of thousands of people dying, there is a justification for pretty extreme measures. But that's not to say that we shouldn't be skeptical of those measures in order to make sure that they aren't too extreme and they don't last longer than they need to. And also that we, you know, that by saying, yes, there is justification for some sort of extreme measures, that we shouldn't then analyse precisely what those measures are.
And do you think from a human rights point of view, I mean, you mentioned the right to life, which is, of course, the most important of the human rights, but the right to association, freedom of association is another famous human right that's listed in the Convention on Human Rights. We don't have the right to associate at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, well, at all times during this pandemic, the government and all public authorities have had to balance the protecting the right to life against not just the right to associate, the right to free speech through protest, the right to family life. You know, the fact that we've at times quite literally not been able to see our families, even, you know, two people in a relationship have not been able to see each other at certain points during this pandemic, and certainly not be indoors with each other if they don't live together. These have been extremely difficult balances, and not ones which should be lightly, you know, jettisoned. We often say in human rights law, you talk about whether there's a logical connection between the measure and the measure that you're trying to impose and the end that you're seeking. So, for example, is it logical to, if the Prime Minister comes out tomorrow and says, right, I'm going to stop people meeting up with one other person for exercise, which is currently one of the exceptions to the rules. Yeah, can that be justified from an epidemiological perspective? Is it strategically appropriate, given that outdoor transmission is really not the focus of the epidemiological evidence? So it's those kind of questions that I think are really important.
If you tune into the kind of media conversation, so much of it is about trying to criticize the government for not doing enough. That's always they are the questions that the Prime Minister gets at number 10. A lot of the columns in newspapers are asking that. Why was there not lockdowns earlier? Why was there too much liberty given at Christmas? All of those questions. And it almost feels like there's no political penalty for errors in the other direction. No one is really worrying about whether they are too draconian or whether this particular restriction is necessary or not. From your point of view, from a human rights law point of view, are you more worried that we have not done enough restrictions, or that, if anything, we've gone too far?
I think I'd come at it from a slightly different perspective, which is I think there has been a pretty hearty debate over restrictions. And pretty much, I guess, since the summer, late summer, when things started getting bad again. I think that in the early days, there was so much uncertainty and so much fear, because really the level of knowledge about this new virus was low. I think the vast majority of people supported, you know, pretty very, very strict restrictions. And also the rest of the world, it seemed, were doing the same thing. So I think there was a real strength in numbers aspect to it. As we got into the second wave, if we're now in the third wave, I guess I'm calling the second wave the autumn, early winter, that led to the November, December lockdown, I think that's when the more skeptical voices started to arise. And my impression, actually, from the government policy is those voices have been quite seriously listened to. And I think the evidence for that is if you compare the March lockdown to the current lockdown, it's really a lot less strict in certain ways. You know, the March lockdown, I mean, when I say that it was so simple, it was 12 pages long, the law. The law now is 120 pages long for the lockdown, for the all tiers regulations. And the reason it's become so long is because you've added all sorts of exceptions that weren't there. So whereas you could only leave your house for a certain limited number of reasons in March, now there are support bubbles, there are childcare support bubbles. In the abstract, and if you tuned into this conversation a year ago, you didn't know what was going on, what we're talking about would sound horrific and, you know, monstrous. You could only, for me, a human rights advocate, saying, well, you know, you should be so lucky you can have one person at your deathbed. And I'm not saying that. That's not where I'm coming from. What I'm trying to say is that the restrictions are less than they were, but the virus is, you know, absolutely, you know, ripping through the country. So I find sometimes with the lockdown skeptic arguments that there's an air of unreality about them, that there is an air of kind of, well, I think quite often, and obviously it's difficult to disentangle when you talk about the lockdown skeptics. You know, there's lots of different there's a range. There's what I consider to be on the really unreasonable kind of COVID denial end of things, which I think is, you know, is just nonsense, basically, and sort of dangerous nonsense, saying really this virus is nowhere near as serious as it's meant to, as it's been said to be. There's a conspiracy, you know, this is all about, I don't know, Bill Gates injecting microchips into us, that sort of thing. I think in the sort of, you know, I do think also there's between there and the what I kind of said is to be a sort of soft lockdown skeptic, there's a middle position, which is still, for me, slightly unreal. It kind of, it's, there's a lot of criticism of the, and a lot of, well, if only you left it up to people's discretion, everything would be fine. And I understand that argument. But I think to a very large extent, we are leaving it up to people's discretion anyway. I think the difference in some ways is quite slim between leaving it up to everybody with strong guidance, which I guess is where those people come from, and having legal rules in place which are technically enforceable but in reality are not being enforced.
The law and the politicians and the media all operate within a kind of current moment and an ecosystem which has fashions and moods and temperatures, and it just seems to me like what is considered virtuous changes according to that mood. So, you know, 2 years ago, you're a human rights advocate. All of the kind of great and the good would really tie themselves to the mast to defend human rights and individual liberties, and that was really a kind of important virtue that people would want to be seen to defend. And now it feels like something has happened where virtuous now looks like acting fast, is how people describe it, you know, doing the more rather than less, quicker rather than slower, not waiting for evidence so much as showing leadership and getting ahead of the problem before, while there's still uncertainty. And I just wonder, are you worried that there's a kind of rush to a more, well, we started off talking about China, a more directly centralized, controlled, all-powerful government as a kind of, as what is widely considered sensible and virtuous?
Going back to the laws and the way they've been developed, the position we've got into now is so fundamentally different to the position we were in a year ago that it's, you know, if you had described it to a public lawyer, so a human rights lawyer at the time, they would have been absolutely, you know, gobsmacked. The idea that these complex criminal laws, which affect everybody's everyday lives in a very fundamental way, can be imposed by a minister signing the law without any pre-parliamentary approval, without any parliamentary vote until 28 days later, and that situation would continue, you know, I've calculated the lockdown laws have changed roughly once every 4.5 days since, on average, since March. So and each and every time in those 65 changes, not a single one of them has gone to a proper parliamentary process. So I think on two occasions out of those 65, there's been a pre-parliamentary vote, but that's been probably usually, I think both times the day before, and they got the law in the morning in draft, and Parliament weren't able to amend. So it was only a yes or a no. And I think that
we've changed the law 65 times in the last year, and none of them have been subject to a parliamentary vote.
No, I think we've changed the law over 300 times in the last year over relating
to COVID. Right.
But 65 just for the lockdown. So the criminal laws, these criminal laws that self-isolation, face coverings, lockdown, those areas that we collectively think of as the lockdown. Those have all been done without using an emergency procedure under the Public Health Act 1984, which allows for this kind of emergency procedure where it's only in extreme circumstances where it's not reasonably possible to put it before Parliament. But I think that I do think that process has been abused, because a very long time ago, probably after the first law was brought in at the end of March, within a couple of weeks, that emergency procedure should have been binned and a proper parliamentary process to be put in place. And I'm not saying a full sort of first reading, second reading, you know, over the course of months kind of process, because I think that's unrealistic. But there could have been a creative solution to the combination of urgency and the need for scrutiny. You know, whether it's 14-day process, which goes through a special committee, can offer amendments, can have a few debates between the Commons and the Lords. I think there's been just a sort of abrogation of parliamentary responsibility over this.
Is there also the length of time? Is that a factor when you think from a human rights point of view that, you know, it's fine if there's suddenly a crisis and we don't really understand it, we get into something akin to martial law where we basically just everybody gets bossed around. But it's now literally more than a year since this virus first emerged, and we don't know how long this might carry on for. There's talk of new variants that might escape vaccines, that, you know, we all hope that the whole thing will come to an end as promised in Easter, but experience teaches us otherwise. At what point is it just not appropriate to have those kind of suspensions of liberty as a long-term way of life?
There are sort of four key things that you need to make good laws. They need to be scrutinized, they need to be lawful, they need to be impermanent, and they need to be proportionate. And that, you know, that scrutiny piece, you know, I was worried then. I mean, that I would have been absolutely shocked to think that there was any possibility of this carrying on. The fact that they've got to be time limited. Well, in fact, they have been time limited, because none of these laws has lasted very long. They've been updated, amended, or changed fundamentally.
They've normally been expanded
not necessarily, because the first lockdown lasted, I think, until May, and then was significantly decreased in size. And then we had the rule of six, that sort of thing. And then it was only in November that they went back to some form of a lockdown. And then since then, it's been, if you live in a tier four area, it's been constant. But I think the what I meant by time limited wasn't that you would have lots of laws and that they would change every few days or every few, you know, every couple of weeks. It was that you wouldn't use the emergency procedures for very long. You would actually bring things into a sort of some sort of normal or semi-normal scrutinizing process. But I think what's happened instead is you've got a very small group of people within Westminster, you know, within the government, not even Parliament, just the government, who decide these rules. They're decided, you know, in consultation with Sage, in consultation with
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Other groups, and that's good, but it's still a very, you know, it's a very imperfect way of dealing with criminal laws that affect everybody. It's not enough.
The question I have is really about timing. That from a legal point of view, at what point do emergency measures cease to be emergency measures? You know, we've hit the 12-month time now. Would it be 16 months, 24 months? At what point could people legitimately say, well, this now feels like a way of life. This now feels like a regime that we are living under. And for those people who don't want to live like that, what can they then do about it?
I mean, I think that's a massive question. I think if you look back in history, you'll see that emergency measures evolve. They tend not to disappear. And the best example in our political memories is the war on terror, where, you know, the terrorism laws that came out of the war that came after September the 11th, I think were passed within, you know, a very, very short period of time.
Yeah.
And they were really seriously different to what we'd had in our law before. And in the most part, as I understand it, they're still there. And the so-called war on terror is, you know, there's always a threat of terrorism. But I think what we recognized as the threat at the time from Al-Qaeda is no longer the same threat. The difference with the war on terror is that the kind of restrictions on liberties were generally around people suspected of terrorism. You know, the security services may have taken on powers that actually allow them to, you know, surveil any of us. The everyday effect of that was not felt by the vast majority of people. Although of human rights advocates, you know, were hot on that because they understood the implications of allowing the Overton window to change, basically, in terms of state surveillance, in terms of detention without trial, those sorts of things. Like, we're always human rights advocates are always looking in a way to the next denial of liberty, because once you normalize a certain kind of restriction on liberty, the next step. It won't remain the same. And that's, you know, we know that from history. I think with COVID, I think the danger is that if COVID never leaves us, or it mutates, or a different virus arrives with a similar kind of virus, and we've got the same dynamic, that we'll be in a kind of semi-permanent state of, you know, this is what we do now when this happens. We have lockdowns, we have emergency laws, we kind of we take away parliamentary niceties like scrutiny, debates, votes, that sort of thing. And I think, I say parliamentary, I mean democratic. And I think that is a danger that I don't think is just one that comes off out of the fringes of the lockdown skeptic or the COVID skeptic movement. I think that's the real deal as a worry, and one that we should be worried about, because you can simultaneously think that a contagious deadly virus such as COVID is a serious enough threat to limit liberties for a period of time, and you can think that sometimes those limitations have to come by way of emergency measures, and also think that the way in which the emergency measures have been used through this pandemic has gone too far, is wrong in its application, and could be done a lot better next time, or even, you know, this time, in the spring when the vaccinations are increasing. This isn't inevitable. The way we're doing things now isn't inevitable, and we can be creative and think of ways that are different.
But I mean, the scenario you have just outlined, where this became a kind of new normal and we spent the next few years or even longer in a period of in-out lockdowns based on new viruses or threats, is absolutely terrifying. I mean, that fear is what animates the kind of global movement against lockdowns. And, you know, at what point will that fear be taken seriously? And how can sensible people start mitigating against that potential outcome without being dismissed as cranks?
Again, going into an area which isn't my own, I think a lot of this is psychology. And one of the things I wrote another article towards the beginning of the pandemic about why human rights are under threat during times of fear. And I think that's the common link between all times of crisis where rights are diminished, where it's very much harder to argue against restrictions of rights when people are fearful, and you know, whether there's a genuine fear or an exaggerated fear, or a fear that maybe is not strong enough. And you could even say that about the beginning of the pandemic. If I had said at the beginning of the pandemic, look, there's a good chance in a year we'll be 100,000 dead from this pandemic, or it wouldn't have been me, but, you know, the prime minister, I think people would have said, come on, that's, you know.
Well, he was told by some experts, he was told a potential figure of 510,000 deaths at the beginning of the
pandemic. Yeah, I think that was with no measures, and I think it was 200,000 with limited measures, and from memory. How do you mitigate our instincts, which are usually, let's dispense with the niceties, let's crack down on something, you know, we've got to crack down on something. And that was I think of that as the Jack Bauer kind of instinct of, you know, why was Jack Bauer 24 the poster boy, the post 9/11 poster boy? It's because he was the one who dispensed with the niceties. You know, forget all this rule of law.
Due process.
Due process. Let's just get the guy in the room, and, you know, the guy with the ticking bomb, and let's torture him until he tells us where the bomb is. And I think that was why human rights were developed in the post-war period, as a concept, because and I don't just mean the principles of giving people equal rights to life, to liberty, to free speech and all that. it's legally enforceable concepts that are built into, baked into the institutions of society, of a democratic liberal society, to make it more difficult in times of fear and times of social breakdown to it makes it stickier, the rights protections we have. It doesn't make it impossible, but it makes it stickier.
Where have those protections been now? I mean, we talk about that, and it's been this institution since the Second World War. Didn't take much, taken 12 months, and now, as you say, we're in a new normal where we await the next restriction on our fundamental liberties in 4.5 days' time, done from a minister with no parliamentary oversight. That's now the way we're governed. And I'm just sincerely asking you, where have all of the human rights advocates, the clerisy, the bureaucrats, the legal advocates, the people who have been talking about the importance of due process and liberty for decades, where have they all gone? Because it seems like they've disappeared.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't really accept that premise. I know that that's the Jonathan Sumption premise as well, as where have the human rights advocates been? I mean, I've been involved in a million discussions. I mean, I'm exaggerating, but since February, these discussions have been had very publicly amongst many, many human rights advocates, you know, in every media. And for example, the Joint Committee on Human Rights that I've been, you know, advising for the past 9 months has made these very points in three successive reports. You know, where is the parliamentary scrutiny? How are these emergency procedures still being used? What can be done about it? Perhaps one answer is our sort of unwritten constitution is a bit too flexible for moments like this. And unless you have a extreme set of circumstances where just the right, you know, composition of the Supreme Court comes along at just the right time where the government pushes things too far, which I think was the prorogation case, the courts are not that interested actually in getting involved in these kind of big social policy issues with lots of balancing factors. I think that's really why the courts have stayed out. I think Parliament, I would flip this back to Parliament. Ultimately, Parliament and the party of government bears responsibility for the way in which the law has been used, because the laws have been made. 65 of these laws, or over 300 if you count all of the coronavirus laws, the laws have been made in Parliament, and they've been rubber stamped every single time by Parliament. So, you know, it was always open to MPs to say, and there was a sort of a hint of this going on with the Steve Baker kind of rebellion in the autumn, at which point the government said, well, where possible, we'll put things to a prior vote, which turned out to be 24 hours before for two votes.
Yeah.
And they forgot about it by tier four. They'd forgotten about it completely. I mean, they just didn't bother. And I think there was a post for this current lockdown. There was a vote the day after it came into force. It's not going to be the lawyers, and it's not going to be the courts who come riding to the rescue here. It has to be our democratically elected parliament that puts its foot down and says, we are ready to approve the right measures, but we are no longer willing to be sidelined.
Do you think, the point I was making earlier about how moods change, ultimately it's politics, isn't it? It's fashions and politics and ways of thinking. And I think what's been quite frightening and unique about this last 12 months is also that there's been a sort of globalized fashion. So this unprecedented way of running a country that started in China and then was imported to Italy and then crossed Europe, and then America somewhat reluctantly came on board with it, and then it now spread all the way around the world. It's sort of become a new orthodoxy, and there are all these charts in the Financial Times comparing different countries' performances, and it's almost like a sort of international league table of governments where the only purpose is to minimize COVID cases and COVID deaths. And it's become this sort of central focus. Do you observe that as well? Do you think that, does it worry you that when those huge big moments like that happen, things like due process and the law become slightly just cast aside, because if the powerful people are all thinking the same thing in all these different countries, you know, there's nowhere to hide.
Yeah, I mean, public mood plays an enormous role. I think there's a good George Orwell quote about it, about something like, if you can have all the laws you want, but if the public mood doesn't want you to, you know, want something, the public mood will get it. And I think that's, in a way, the human rights legal framework is designed to attempt to solve that problem. Is you know, in exactly the same way as the separation of powers system, you know, any checks and balances by definition are there to make it harder to just ramroad over liberties and, you know, existing laws. Whether I think that, look, the
are they, I guess, I, do you I feel meant, are they holding up? Do you still have confidence that those checks and balances are going to do the job we so much need them to do?
I think that come the spring, the public mood will change again. I think we're currently talking, you know, in the middle of January 2021, in the worst part of the pandemic so far, you know, the most number of daily deaths, the NHS being overwhelmed. This is it's a very difficult time to stand up and, you know, in the middle of the road and say, well, 1 minute, what about the restrictions? Because it just is, you know, it's a very difficult, and in a way it should be difficult to do that, because it is very frightening that so many people are dying every single day. Over 1,000 people, you know, are being reported every day. It's very frightening. However, I do think these things move. My experience is, in a month's time, I think we'll be having different conversations. And I really hope that by the summer, if the virus is much more under control because of the vaccine, which hopefully it will be, we can have a really serious conversation about, well, what didn't we like about what happened? You know, in the cold light of day, take the emotion out of it. What was right and what was wrong? I don't think it's the right question. Did lockdowns work? Because I think that simplifies lockdown. You know, lockdowns involve lots of measures, from, you know, the leaving home measures, the gathering measures, the self-isolation measures, the face covering measures, the travel quarantine measures. You know, it's I think you've got to look at each of the measures and say, what worked, what didn't, what was worth it and what wasn't. And for that, you have to look carefully about what were the second order effects, the unintended consequences of these, you know, economically, psychiatrically, you know, all of the things that people worry about, how many delayed operations, how many people weren't able to get cancer treatment, those sorts of things. And I think you have to do a kind of reckoning. And that's, I mean, that's the role that I think a public inquiry needs to play, because I think that's the kind of, public inquiries are cold environments. I've been involved in lots of them. And I mean, they are the least emotive way of dealing with very emotive questions, because nothing takes the emotion out of a room like a bunch of lawyers talking to each other. You know,
in a way,
we can make anything boring.
Well, that, I hope that happens. In a way, though, it requires that lull, doesn't it? It requires things to go well and for there to be a calmer temperament come the summer for us to be able to put in place, you know, restrictions against restrictions in some way, new checks and balances to make sure that we don't get this kind of style of government becoming a new normal. I have to ask you, though, if that doesn't happen, the lull in the summer, if there are new variants and if this threat does carry on and if tempers remain heated, will you and your colleagues in the human rights world start making the more unpopular step of saying, hold on, even though we're not going to get plaudits in The Guardian for this and we're not going to get everybody liking our tweets, we're still going to say, actually, this is no longer acceptable?
Yeah, I mean, that is human rights advocates should be gadflies. You know, we should be unpopular. That's why I think Shami Chakrabarty, you know, played such an important role in the war on terror and was such a divisive figure, because she asked the difficult questions, and she did it in a very articulate way. That's one of my influences when I came into this field. I think that's the role of, you know, these, there's a sort of element of being the court jester in a way, not in a, we're not funny, but being the, asking the awkward questions, being difficult, being difficult and standing in the way of what we think are injustices, even if they're unpopular. So yeah, I mean, I don't think ever been fearful of playing that role. I've just thought during this pandemic that, you know, it's not always been obvious what the right answer is from a human rights perspective, because there is this very strong imperative to protect life, and it's been a, you know, really, really catastrophic pandemic. You know, beyond, I mean, in my lifetime, only AIDS was, you know, played HIV and AIDS was that level of, you know, severity. And I think that's the, you know, it's there's lots of public health questions. It's, I think also it's a kind of cross-disciplinary question, what's right and what's wrong. That's what's so difficult, to be able to really understand and reach answers. I think on this, you have to have lawyers, you have to have scientists, you have to have doctors, you have to have ethicists, you have to have philosophers. You know, it's such a big question and such an important one that, you know, it's that will have to be what happens.
Okay, Adam, thank you so much. I look forward to that. I'm really hearing what you're saying. I'm heartened that you also have some of the same concerns about what might transpire in the future. And it's great to know that you're focusing on that. And we will we'll watch it with interest. So thank you for your time.
Thanks, Freddie.
That was Adam Wagner, human rights expert and barrister at Doughty Street Chambers, sharing his thoughts on the legal side of lockdowns. We've seen laws being made in ways that we're not used to, and there's been an awful lot of them. I think he said there were 65 changes to lockdown laws over the course of the past year. So that was absolutely fascinating. Don't forget, you can watch all of our podcast interviews on our YouTube channel. Find us under Unheard and make sure to subscribe for all the latest. Thanks for joining.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.